So let's start. I'm going to say a couple of minutes introduction. And but first of all, welcome everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm William Bloom, and this Compassion Dialogue is with Rupert Sheldrake. Welcome, Rupert. Thank you for being with us. Before properly introducing you, Rupert, a few words about this series of dialogues. It's hosted by the Spiritual Companions Trust. It's a UK educational charity, and we develop resources for people who are spiritual but not necessarily religious. In all these dialogues, our purpose is to explore what influences, motivates, and inspires influential spiritual authors, teachers, and activists, and hopefully inspire you too. More love, more compassion, more consciousness. Coming up in a couple of weeks in this series, I'll be talking with Lynn Sedgmore. Now, you may not have heard of her, but she is deeply interesting. Lynn is from a working class background, but she developed her career to become the principal of Guildford College, then Dean of Croydon Business School, and then Chief Executive of the National Centre for Excellence in Leadership. She then left her mainstream career, moved down to Glastonbury, and is trained in goddess spirituality. That's a huge shift from that mainstream career into the counterculture around Glastonbury. And she has some really interesting insights into how goddess and female culture can be integrated into hardcore mainstream leadership. Don't miss it. And now to properly introduce Rupert. A formal introduction, Rupert, would talk about your prestigious mainstream background, Cambridge, Royal Society, your development of the theory of the morphic field, and your methodologically rigorous experiments that challenge a materialistic science and worldview. And of course, your many books. I don't know which ones to name, Presence of the Past, The Sense of Being Stared At, Science and Spiritual Practices, Seven Experiments That Could Change the World, Physics of Angels with Matthew Fox, and so on. But I want to give you a different kind of stroke and compliment. And I think a lot of people watching this and listening to it will also feel the same way that I do. So the main thing I want to say, Rupert, before we talk, is that I think you've been heroically helpful in creating a cultural space where people can feel safe to explore the intersection of spirituality, mysticism, metaphysics with the rigor of mainstream science. And in this role of creating this safe space between spirituality and science, you've had to endure a lot of unpleasant attacks. And for that, thank you. And thank you for being part of creating a space that's been very helpful for all of us. So, Rupert, what I'd love to hear, first of all, because before we come to your ideas, is your background and what motivates you. Would you tell us something about what your childhood was like? Family, where you lived.
All right. I was born in near Carn-trent in Nottinghamshire, which is a market town. My father was a herbalist and a pharmacist, and a quite prominent figure in public life. He was a count on the town council. He was chairman of the library committee, governor of the local grammar school, where he'd been to school himself, and ran the New York Music Club and so on. So he was very actively involved in public life. My mother was also involved in public life, and also helped my father with his business. Both of them were Methodists, and I came from on both sides of the family. My grandfather, my father's father, was the organist of the main Methodist church in Newark. And then as a child, I used to I learned music from an early age, five, playing the piano. I learned the organ later when I was a teenager. But when I was quite young, I used to sit with my grandfather on the organ stool to turn the pages for him, which I very much enjoyed doing. And then my father's brother took over as organist. So I come from a long line of organists and musicians, and they were also choir masters. So I grew up in Newark, which I was born during the war. So in my early childhood, there was rationing until I was aged, what, nine. And so there were very few luxuries. We had one room in the house that was heated with a coal fire, and no other rooms were heated. So, I mean, this was normal at the time. We didn't have a car, we only had bicycles because you couldn't get cars during the war. It was fairly simple and local life. I kept lots of pets. I enjoyed being in the garden. We had a kind of secret garden, which I loved going to a few minutes' walk from our home, a walled garden with an orchard. And I think, generally speaking, I had a happy childhood. I went to boarding school when I was 10, to a prep school in Nottinghamshire, and then to Worksop College, another boarding school in Nottinghamshire. When I was there, I studied science, got a scholarship to Cambridge. So much of my childhood was in Nottinghamshire, in fairly obscure places, with a fairly low profile environment. But for me, it was a very nurturing and generally happy environment.
Let me ask you a question, because I'm always very interested in the experience that people have at boarding school. Because your happy childhood, lots of animals, the walled garden, and then off to all boys boarding school. How was that for you? Because quite often that's a very wounding experience for people.
Well, I mean, obviously, it was a big shock at first. I wasn't used to sleeping in a dormitory with lots of other boys, and I had a brother, so I was used to being with, playing with boys. Well, I mean, it was a sort of shock, but I adapted. I mean, most people adapt to it, and I just thought of it as normal. I didn't think it was sort of strange, weird, or after all the other boys in the boarding school were in the same situation as me. So it was rather austere, Spartan, corporal punishment. It was very old school.
Did you get beaten ever?
Oh yes,
What had you done to incur the wrath of the masters? Do you remember?
Oh well, I did several things. We had fagging too, and I was the fag for a particularly obnoxious prefect. I was studying chemistry, so I hit on this idea of generating hydrogen sulfide from ferrous sulfide and hydrochloric acid, and had a test tube which I wanted to have this sort of stink bomb type stuff in his study because I thought, I thought it'd be a kind of practical joke. But it wasn't giving off the hydrogen sulfide very much, so I propped it up against the radiator and went off to the tuck shop. When I got back, there were billowing clouds of these fumes all down the corridor, and the prefect sort of holding it at arm's length to try and flush it down the lavatory. And of course, he and everybody else instantly knew who must have done this. So that was six of the best. I think other infractions were, and they were mostly kind of breaking rules of various kinds. I was fairly rebellious when I was a child at school.
Because according to some of the biographies, you then, when everybody else was being confirmed into the Church of England, you refused.
Yes, I was. I had a. I had a housemaster who was quite intellectually adventurous, and he was a biologist. He taught me biology, and what I learned from my science teachers was basically scientific materialism. You know, the orthodoxy of science, which is atheistic, and so I got the impression that to be a scientist, you have to be an atheist. That's certainly the culture at the time. I wanted to be a scientist, so I sort of bought into this atheistic worldview. And my housemaster wasn't actually a crude Dawkins-type atheist. He was a much more interesting one. His point was to try and show that Christianity was actually no better than pre-Christian pagan religions, which we'd all been taught to denounce. He gave me parts of Sir James Frazer's book, The Golden Bough, to read, Robert Graves's book, The White Goddess. I was a bit older than 14 when I read those. All of this led to, at quite an early age, to a kind of questioning of conventional religion. Yes, I was. I mean, I was quite rebellious. It was a school where the principal emphasis was on rugby and the combined cadet force. It was somewhat an anti-intellectual atmosphere. And so it wasn't the perfect school for me. But I had some good friends there and, you know, survived, and mostly through humour.
What I'm taking from this though, Rupert, is that you're either as a young boy, as a boy, an adolescent, you're either thick-skinned or actually quite tough. And as you said, you were a little bit rebellious as well. And so what you then had to deal with later on in your career with the hostility of atheistic scientists was something that wouldn't have come as a shock to you because you were already quite tough and rebellious as a teenager.
Yes, I mean, part of the ethos of the boarding schools, were boys' boarding schools when I was at school, was in fact to toughen people up. And it actually worked in my own case. I mean, for example, when we were on, it was compulsory to be in the combined cadet force, you know, the army cadet. And in the summer, we went on summer camps. We went to a former prisoner of war camp in Perthshire in Scotland. And it was quite tough. You know, we were trained by people in the army. We had to wade through raging torrents of rivers, fix a rope and so on, so we didn't get carried away. We had to do assault courses. And then one of the things they did was we were in groups of three, and we were told we could take as much kit as we liked, but we had to carry it. And they then put us in an army lorry, drove with us in the back so we couldn't see where we were going. And then deposited us, this little group of three I was in, on a remote road in the Highlands in the rain. And we had to get back to the camp, and it was quite a long way. And we had to work out where we were from a map. We had to find places to sleep at night. You know, no one would be allowed to do that today. It would violate almost every health and safety regulation and consider
The only place you'd be allowed to do this is in a TV reality show.
Yes, exactly, with people from TV watching you all the time. Well, there was no one watching us, and you know, we could have got hopelessly lost. And it was called an initiative test. And actually, it was a real test of initiative, and it was like a kind of rite of passage. Some of the things we did in the cadet force, you know, as part of army training. And actually, I appreciate it. You know, I think it was. Really did help one to become more resilient.
To show what a hippie I am, I also went to a private school, but I didn't board. But I hold the honor of being the only platoon leader in the Combined Cadet Force to lose his platoon in Richmond Park.
Yes.
Really, really, slightly pathetic, not quite as honourable a story as yours. But things, what's interesting for me is your image as a quite careful scientist with this Christian Anglican stuff going on in the background as well, and theological discussions, belies the fact that you're actually quite a tough preacher.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's different degrees of toughness. I didn't wouldn't do too well in some extreme physical ordeals, I suppose. But no, we were. I think this really was one of the benefits of the education that I received. That, and when I was at school, we were being trained to run the empire, basically, most people I was at school with did actually go into the army, or some became district commissioners in Africa and that sort of thing. And I myself spent 7 years in India and a year in Malaysia. So actually, I was doing more or less what I was trained to do. I didn't think of it that way at the time, but in retrospect, I can see that I was trained up for, to be able to live in very unfamiliar surroundings in foreign countries.
So listen, we'll come to this in a bit because I think that gave you the strength to deal with the levels of hostility that you had to deal with. I mean, I had an office underneath John Maddox's office in near Fleet Street for a while, and I know what a raging scientific journalist he was, and he was very, very hostile and aggressive to you at one point. But listen, let's fast forward. Let's go through past Cambridge, and you're in India, and there's that sense of adventure or duty or whatever it is that allowed you to, or guided you to be there for that length of time. Was it also there? Because I know you spent some time with Bede Griffiths. Was it also in India that you started to return to, well, having refused confirmation, you're coming in a circle back to home in a way? What went on?
Well, one reason I went to India was that I took up a job there. I was the principal plant physiologist at the International Crops Research Institute in Hyderabad. I started that job in 1974. But one reason I was very keen on India was that I travelled through India for several months in 1968, which was a very exciting year to be in India, on my way to Malaysia, where I had a Royal Society sponsored time in the botany department of the University of Malaya, where I was studying rainforest ferns, tropical ferns. Anyway, on the way to the tropical ferns, I was traveling through India, and I had wonderful adventures in India. I absolutely loved the culture, was fascinated by it. And it made me realize that this atheistic philosophy, the mechanistic materialist philosophy, the atheist view, there's no such thing as any kind of spirit out there. It's all just in your brain. Your mind's nothing but the activity of your brain. It's all inside your head. Practically no one I met in India believed all that. And they had these wonderfully exotic forms of religion and ritual and temples and pilgrimages and sacred animals and holy trees and so on. I loved all that. I loved the sort of idea of the sacredness of life, holy animals and sacred groves and so forth.
So let me come in there and ask you a very direct question, because this is what really intrigues me about you in a way, which is, having heard very carefully what you've just said, there's one way of looking at it is, you're a scientific observer watching culture around you, and there's such a wave of multi-dimensional spirituality that your brain is assessing all that intellectually and going, oh, there must be something there that makes sense. And or you're also having an experience. And I would love you to kind of unpack those two.
Well, on 1968, on this first visit to India, which planted the seeds for going there again later, it was because of that I wanted to go back to India and have a job there, work there and live there. I've been in Delhi. First place I arrived for just 2 or 3 days, and I was amazed by this vibrant culture. When I ran into the only person I actually knew in India, I didn't know he'd be in Delhi then. It was a friend of mine from Cambridge who was an anthropologist working in a remote village in the Himalayas. And he said, "I'm going back to my village tomorrow. Would you like to come?" So I said, "Yes." So I went with him, and I was plunged right into the heart of rural India within a few days of arriving. We had to walk several hours from the road head. We had to take the train and then a bus and then walk because, and the village was off the grid. There was no electricity, no TV, no radio. It's very traditional. He spoke the local language. And I was fascinated by being there. And one day we went for a walk along a little river, a Himalayan mountain stream, and beside it there was a cave. In the cave was this orange clad figure. So I said, "Who's that?" And he said, "Oh, that's the local holy man, the sadhu." And the sadhu sort of waved to us, he'd come along, and so he invited us to go and sit with him on the mouth of his cave. Then he produced this chilim, which I'd never seen before, this clay pipe. And he asked me if I'd like to try Shiva's holy plant. And I wasn't quite sure what this was, but he said it was a holy plant. He'd get an invocation to Shiva. I thought it might be cannabis, and indeed it was. I hadn't had cannabis before. And so I smoked, it was terribly strong, and it must have had other things mixed in. But anyway, the effect was that I felt this huge opening when I went out of the cave onto the grass and looked at the mountains, those snow-capped Himalayas that were around, and there was this tremendous sense of a divine presence, of just a presence of a consciousness vastly greater than anything I'd experienced or anticipated or known about. And it was a kind of mystical experience for me, and it was a wonderful way of entering India, because it meant that from then on, I saw India through this completely different lens of through this intense experience of connection and presence. And I felt hugely at home in India, which is why it became such a big part of my life. But this was my introduction. So it wasn't just observing and being intellectual, it was also the opening up of realms of experience that I'd never had before. And later, I took up transcendental meditation and yoga when I got back to England, because I was very influenced by this Indian experience.
So, what you describe as an experience of the universality and the connection between everything and the, I'm not sure what word, I don't want to put any words in your mouth, but of a presence that's divine and wonderful and awesome and mysterious. That is entwined from that point, that's entwined with your life right until now.
Oh yes, very definitely. And when I was in traveling through India, visiting great temples, and then in Sri Lanka, I visited a Buddhist monastery and talked to a monk who explained to me about meditation. And I realized there were huge areas that I knew nothing about that were fascinating to do with consciousness, literally enlarging the view of the mind through experience. And when I went back to Cambridge after this year in Asia, which also included traveling in Laos and Cambodia, after Malaysia, that was before they were engulfed by the Vietnam War and all the terrible tragedies that unfolded there afterwards. Then I think around 1970, I had my first experience of LSD when I was in Cambridge. And this was even more mind-opening and transformative for me, and it completely changed my view of the nature of consciousness. It was a kind of near-death experience, death and rebirth type experience. And from then on, I was really very interested. That's when I took up meditation, and yoga, and I started reading about Indian philosophy. I mean, I was carry on doing my scientific research in the biochemistry department. I was teaching, I was a fellow of Clare College, I was teaching cell biology and so on, all that continued. But it gave me this whole other set of interests.
All right, so we now have this. I'm going to be sound quite crude. We now have this dual career, then, don't we? Or this dual Rupert, one of which is the Clare College Don, and the other of which is the raving mystic, the the transcendentalist, the expanding consciousness, metaphysical creature. And that's an interesting polarity to hold in yourself.
Well, I mean, I did try to apply this more holistic worldview that had come to me through these experiences to science itself. And in fact, even when I was an undergraduate, I thought that the mechanistic materialist view was very limited. I mean, I did biology because I loved plants and animals. Kept all these pets as a child. My father taught me about plants. I had a collection of pressed plants. I knew about wildflowers and so on, and herbs. But when I was studying biology at Cambridge, and indeed at school, the first thing we did with the organisms we were studying was to kill them. And so then it was all about working out the mechanisms by which they live, the molecular mechanisms and so forth, molecular biology. And I found that much too limited. I was studying life because I was interested in the nature of life. I kept homing pigeons as a child. I wanted to know how pigeons home. No one knows even today. But those were the kinds of questions I was interested in. And so I found mechanistic biology I was studying and then doing research in rather unsatisfying. So I was exploring ways of interpreting life scientifically, but in a more holistic manner. So I was reading Goethe to start with, and on his work on plants and on theories of colour, and then history and philosophy of science. I spent a year at Harvard doing history and philosophy of science because I wanted to get a bigger picture. And then I got interested in my work on plant development at Cambridge was. Had a kind of holistic element. I discovered that the main hormone of plants, auxin, auxin, indoleacetic acid, it's quite closely related to tryptophan, the amino acid, and tryptamine and 5-hydroxytryptamine or serotonin. I discovered that the main plant hormone that gives more life and growth is actually made by dying cells released as they break down. And that was quite a major discovery. And in fact, my latest paper on the subject was published only 2 years ago in the Journal of Experimental Botany. So it's an area that I kept an interest in. This was still within the framework of mechanistic biology, but had the idea of death and life being so intertwined within organisms was for me a fascinating idea. And then, as I thought more about the nature of development of form in plants, I got interested in morphogenetic fields, form-shaping fields. Then I tried to understand how they're inherited, and that's when I came up with the idea of morphic resonance. That was in 1973, so it's exactly 50 years ago. And so my scientific thinking when I was at Cambridge was definitely bursting out of the more conventional attitudes in the biochemistry department. Because of the Cambridge College system, my colleagues in Clare, where I lived in college because I was a bachelor, ate on high table most nights. I had plenty of chance to talk to philosophers and historians about these ideas, and they really helped in getting a broader perspective. So it wasn't completely separate compartments, sort of narrow mechanistic biology and spiritual interest in the other. There was a whole area between of trying to explore more holistic ways of understanding life and mind.
So let me ask another question then, which is to do with how you experience meditation. I've been practicing and teaching meditation for almost 50 years, and one of the things I know is that people have different ways, have different types of experience in meditation. They have different sensitivities, their consciousness works in different ways. Those folk who have a more, what I would call, more psychic sensibility in their meditations, they are aware of experientially, sensually, kinesthetically, not just in consciousness, aware of a field of energy that connects everything. And they would be aware of the field of energy around a plant and aware of its relationship with the energies of other plants. And that might be interpreted as nature spirits, for example. So what I'm curious about is whether your research as a mainstream botanist was also being informed by insights that were coming in meditation.
I can't remember how many of the insights when I was in Cambridge came to me in meditation. But certainly, when I was living in Father Bede's ashram and writing my book, my first book, A New Science of Life, about morphic resonance, we had an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening. I was meditating on the bank of the sacred river Cauvery, outdoors under a tree. And although I was concentrating on my mantra and stuff, and flashes of ideas and would come to me in the meditation. It was like being open to new ideas, fresh insights. If I was stuck in my writing and didn't know quite how to finish a chapter, suddenly the idea would come to me. I wasn't meditating in order for that to happen. In fact, that's not the point, as I understood it, of meditation. But nevertheless, these things did happen while I was meditating, and they still do. I get, flashes of insight as well as lots of distracting thoughts.
Do you also, because I really want to explore how the two aspects of yourself integrate. In your silent practice, in your meditation, do you have a sense of the divine presence
Well,
in the emptiness?
I'm more try in the meditation. It's more which I use a mantra. Now I use a Christian mantra. It's more trying to just come back to the mantra, and sometimes I definitely have a sense of the divine presence. But I would say that in my own private practice, in the mornings I meditate, in the evenings I pray. I'd say I probably have more sense of divine presence in when I'm praying, because after all, prayer involves an invocation of the divine. I mean, all prayers begin with an invocation, like Our Father who art in heaven, or Hail Mary, full of grace. So you start with an invocation of a divine or saintly being. I feel a stronger sense of divine presence, really, in prayer than in meditation, because prayer is more about that. Meditation's, for me, more about just keep coming back to the mantra and allowing the thoughts to flow through and dissipate and so on.
You have it also in music playing, because you do still play organ.
I still play the organ, but not as much as the piano. I play the piano every day, and I play Bach almost every day. And yes, I certainly get this feeling of kind of transcendent presence through music, especially Bach. And particularly the main live music I go to is in I love going to choral evensong in cathedrals and Westminster Abbey. And there, there's this, this sublimely beautiful music echoing around these sacred spaces. I find that immensely moving and opening, and I definitely feel a divine presence in holy buildings like cathedrals, especially when there's music as well.
So, when I was in my 20s and 30s and first started reading you and being aware of your work, I was coming from an explicit psychic metaphysical perspective. So, when, and I think this is going to bring, this is a question that a lot of people will be interested in. In reading about morphic resonance and the morphic field, from my experience on LSD and in meditation and other circumstances, I was going, ah, yay, Rupert is describing in a completely different language the, now there were all kinds of words for it, etheric, chronic, God's presence, Holy Ghost, that you were actually describing the fact that space is not empty, but is in actual fact an ocean of consciousness energy, which it's a mystery. Not quite, we don't quite have the language or the kits, definitely don't have the kit to calculate what it's made up of. But that's how I was reading everything you were writing at the time. And I had lots of friends also going, well, have you seen the scientist over here? He's talking about all the stuff we have our experiences with. And were you having those conversations with people who are already in the kind of metaphysical, psychic, spiritual world?
Oh yes, I mean, after all, I was living in India after when I resigned my fellowship at Clare College, Cambridge, and took up this job in an agricultural institute in India. I was immersed in Indian culture. You know, I used to go to discourses by gurus. I used to discuss with Hindu friends, their philosophy. I met sort of Hindu sages who would explain, talked about the Upanishads. I had a Sufi master in Hyderabad as well, who I was close to. I wrote my book, A New Science of Life, my first book about morphic resonance, living in the ashram of Father Bede Griffiths on the bank of the sacred river. And I discussed it with Father Bede, who was very, very well grounded in Hindu philosophy, gave discourses on the Upanishads as well as on St. Thomas Aquinas and Christian philosophy. And he introduced me to the mystical tradition in Christian and Western philosophy, which I didn't know much about before. So yes, I was very immersed in that world. I also used the Theosophical Society library in Madras when I needed a library. That was the nearest library to where I was living in this ashram in Tamil Nadu. And when I was at the Theosophical Society, I used to go to talks and lectures and so on. So yes, but in my book, I deliberately kept the book purely scientific because my aim in that book and in my other books on science is to try and open up what's happening within the sciences. And I realized that talking about mystical philosophy would be counterproductive, so I just stuck to the actual science. And although the idea of morphic resonance, memory and nature has a lot in common with Hindu ideas on karma or even theosophical ideas on the Akashic records, I didn't put these in my book because I thought they'd just be like press buttons for people that would harm the what I was trying to do, which was make a scientific argument on scientific terms for a broader kind of science. And that's what I'm still trying to do, really.
Still trying to do really good. I see in the 60s and 70s, it felt like you were, and I'm thinking also of Fritjof Capra and other people in similar parallel fields. There was a kind of the worldview, what was shifting, that there was an increasing acceptance that there was a mysterious element to consciousness and life that we needed to be exploring in a way that wasn't purely materialistic. And then in the 80s, especially in The Guardian and the BBC, the Bad Science Brigade took off, targeting folk like you and targeting anybody who was making any proposition that couldn't be scientifically justified. So 50 years on, Rupert, looking back, how do you feel it's all gone?
I think that the narrow dogmatic materialism that was totally predominant when I was an undergraduate and working in Cambridge is definitely softening at the edges. I mean, in all sorts of ways. partly through, in physics, the Big Bang theory, the evolutionary cosmology, gives us a grand evolutionary picture of the universe. That only became orthodox in physics in 1966. And this gives a much bigger sweep of thinking. It's also clear that physics, the picture of physics, is extremely incomplete. The fact that, according to modern cosmology, 95% of the universe is made up of dark matter and dark energy, of which we know nothing, shows that our actual science, where we do know something, is based on only about 5% of reality. Now, that's an astonishing admission of science. It used to be this hard-nosed, hardcore materialism, science knows practically everything kind of attitude, whereas the official view in physics is, well, there's 95% of reality we hardly know anything about at all. Then in biology, the sort of Dawkins-type selfish gene neo-Darwinism has given way to the extended evolutionary synthesis with epigenetic inheritance, the inheritance of acquired characters, the inheritance of culture being part of it, and so on. A much broader view of evolution, much more attractive view. Consciousness studies has opened up a whole area of science to studying the nature of altered states of consciousness, near-death experiences, lucid dreaming, psychedelic experience, and so forth. So in all these areas, there's been a tremendous opening up. And also, I think the ecological crisis has made many people realize that our attitude to the environment, which used to be one of just pure and simple, dominate it and make as much profit as possible and so forth. The Gaia hypothesis has helped to make almost everyone realize that we live on a planet where everything's interlinked and interconnected. So all of these things have led to a much more holistic kind of science. But within institutional science, the mechanistic orthodoxy is still the dominant one. And it may go on for quite a long time, not because everyone believes in it, but because that's the way you get a job and the way you get a grant. In my experience, the number of scientists who actually believe in mechanistic materialism of the kind of Dawkins type is a small minority, but they're very vociferous. Lots of scientists are longing for the day when to be more open to things that are spiritual with a more holistic approach, and when it's possible to do research in a broader way. So I think things have changed quite a lot. Organizations like the Scientific and Medical Network and the Institute of Noetic Sciences have helped to bring together people within the sciences and within the medical world who are working towards change. So it's no longer just a few isolated individuals, it's become more of a coordinated movement.
But in relation to shifting the paradigm substantially, will it ever be able to shift unless there's some kit that can actually measure subtle energies and consciousness? Because that's the foundation of the materialistic science, isn't it? You acquire some kit that can measure.
Well, yes. I mean, I'm not against measurement. I do research on telepathy, for example, telephone telepathy, and it's measurable. You know, how I do my experiments is that people who say they're telepathic name four people they might be telepathic with. They sit by a landline phone being filmed with no caller ID. We pick one of the four callers at random, ring them up and ask them to call the subject. So when the phone rings, they know it's one of these four people, but they can't know in any normal way which one, because they're picked at random. So before they answer the phone, they have to say who it is. I think it's Jill. Hello, Jill. They're right or they're wrong. And they have a one in four chance of being right by pure guessing. In fact, in these experiments, the hit rate's about 45%, which with hundreds of trials is very, very significantly, statistically significantly more than chance. So here's something, telepathy, which a lot of so-called skeptics dismiss as nonsense, But it really happens, and you can actually show it happens with statistical experiments. I spend much of my time doing this kind of research. So it is measurable. And morphic resonance is measurable. There's a student at the moment working on morphic resonance says that if lots of people have learned something, it gets easier to learn. So every single day, there's a kind of morphic resonance experiment going on with Wordle, a five-letter word puzzle that's published every morning by the New York Times. All day long, people are doing it. And my prediction is it should be easier to do Wordle in the evening than it is in the morning. And this is repeated every day, so you could replicate this. So unfortunately, the New York Times are terrible spoil sports. When I asked them to see the data to test this, they just said no, and they didn't want to look at it themselves either. So I suppose they just prefer a quiet life. But there's now a student who's recruiting people to do it at different times of day and build up a whole database of to see whether this is true. Well, their morphic resonance is testable. Either people will learn it quicker or they won't. And you can do statistical analysis. A lot of scientific research is statistical, using standard statistical methods. All these things can actually be tested. And after, with spiritual practices like meditation, although the sense of connection is something you'd have to rely on somebody telling you about, as you know, you can measure blood pressure and sort of stress hormone levels in the blood, brain waves and stuff. All these things change. Spiritual practices, as I show in my book, Science and Spiritual Practices, have measurable effects. And generally speaking, people who have religious or spiritual practices are happier, healthier, and live longer than those that don't. This is again measurable, and it's been measured, and there's thousands of papers about this now.
When you were talking about the knowing who's going to phone you, the name that came out of your mouth was Jill, who's your wife. Do you know when Jill is going to phone you? Phone rings?
Well, no, I don't very much.
No.
It was partly because we don't. I don't have a mobile phone. I don't
No.
like phones.
No, that's fine.
My whole life is actually avoiding phone calls. I mean, I don't. I do have a landline, but I discourage people ringing me. So, I don't actually with Jill. I'm not terribly psychic myself. When I've done my own experiments with my research assistant, Pam Smart, then we both score above chance, but we're not kind of in the top flight of psychics. I mean, I'm moderately psychic.
So listen, you and put this politely. Where you? I also. You're in the last decades of your life. Where's your focus now? Is it on spiritual practice, music, research, teaching, waving the flag for a shift in culture? Where are you? Where's your heart? Where's your heart at now?
Well, I mainly do research at the moment. I'm not writing any more books. I think I've written enough books. And in terms of reaching people, YouTube is a more effective method for me. So I have a YouTube channel. I do a lot of YouTubes and talks and dialogues. So that's part of my effort. I give talks. I give as few as possible now because they take up a lot of time and. But I prioritize students. So I give talks in some schools to the sixth form, most recently at Eton, and to student societies. I'm giving one next week to the Sussex University Psychedelic Research Society. It's a student society in Sussex University. My main day-to-day work is research, and I've published about six papers in peer-reviewed journals just in the last year. It's probably the
Oh.
most productive year of my whole life so far.
Well done.
The last one was on end-of-life experiences in dogs and cats because they show many of the same phenomena that humans do when they're dying, including something that's analogous to terminal lucidity, a kind of clarity. if they've been confused before, there's a sort of surge of energy and clarity. I have another paper that's just come out on the sense of being stared at being directional, where I've studied about 1,000 different case studies and found that it's almost always the case that when people feel they're being stared at, they don't just look around vaguely feeling uneasy. They usually turn straight round and look straight at the person looking at them. And this happens with animals too. Animals turn and look at a person, or you can be, if an animal looks at you, you can turn and find there's an animal looking at you. So that's called directional scopesthesia, that paper. I've got another one coming out shortly on experiments I've done to find out if people can tell when they're being listened to. They can certainly tell when they're being stared at, but I wanted to know if people could tell when they're being listened to on the telephone. So I had an automated app for testing this. And the answer is that people don't seem to be able to tell when they're being listened to. I thought they would. You know, this was a surprise to me, but the results are quite clear. Then I have another paper coming out soon on after-death contacts with animals. When people die, very often people see them, feel them, smell them, feel them, you know, after they've died. The same kind of thing happens with beloved dogs and cats. People feel the cat jump up onto the bed, you know, even though it's been dead for a week or something.
Where are these papers being published? And can we find them on your website?
Yeah, they're all on my website. The listening test and the after-death contacts ones are still in the press. They're coming out soon. But the end-of-life experiences with animals, the directional scopesthesia, another paper fairly recently called Is the Sun Conscious? Exploring panpsychism and the consciousness of the sun. That's in the Journal of Consciousness Studies. Two of the others are in the Journal of Scientific Exploration. You know, there's a variety of journals. I wrote a paper on cellular senescence following up some work I did at Cambridge. That was a couple of years ago. That's in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. So these are in mainstream scientific journals. And all of them, I have to go through the peer review process, and which is in some ways tedious because you have to deal with nitpicking anonymous critics. But on the other hand, all of the papers that all my papers have been peer reviewed, and I think all of them have benefited from it because, you know, they've become better and stronger as a result of these criticisms.
But changing vibe, changing topic, but not changing it that much. As you approach the last decades of your life, what's your own personal take on death, both in terms of what you think happens and how you're preparing for it?
I'm very conscious of my age. I'm 81, so I'm very conscious that, you know, death gets nearer. And part of my regular practice as an Anglican is I pray every day. When I'm praying, I start my prayers with the Lord's Prayer, and then I say the Hail Mary. And the bottom line of the Hail Mary is, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. So every day I ask the Blessed Virgin Mary, the Mother of God, to pray for me at the hour of the death. So like a kind of guide or midwife of the dying process. So you could say that's a kind of preparation. I think that when we die, we probably go on dreaming, but we can't wake up anymore. So my own way of thinking about it is that, you know, we're all used to having another body. Every time we dream, we have a body in our dreams, a dream body that can walk around, talk to people, see things, sometimes fly, and so on. So we're all used to, ever since we were, even probably before we were born, because unborn babies seem to dream. All our life, we've had another life in a dream world with a dream body. And then we wake up. But after we're dead, we can't wake up anymore. So I think we're trapped, as it were, in the dream world. And that can be how it is, would depend on the kind of person you are, your memories, your fears, your desires, your spiritual beliefs, your spiritual helpers. and so on. So, and I think psychedelic experiences are really a kind of dream world, supercharged dream world type experiences. And many people on psychedelics encounter entities or beings which seem to be autonomous, ancestors, spirits, saints, perhaps demons. And I think that that's another way of tasting what life after death may be like. And in the Tibetan tradition, there's the idea of the bardo, an intermediate realm. And as you know, the reason some Tibetan monks do dream yoga, they practice lucid dreaming, is how, because they think they can navigate more easily in the bardo if they know how to control their dreams or be aware of what's happening. I don't practice lucid dreaming myself, but the traditional Christian view in the Roman Catholic tradition is that we enter an intermediate zone, purgatory, where there's continued development. We're still perhaps to some degree in contact with the living. It's on November the 2nd this week, it's All Souls Day, the Day of the Dead. It's a really big deal in Mexico, and that's all about this connection with the dead. So I think that I'd be in some kind of realm of that kind. And since I'm a Christian, I think one of the great points of Christianity, the doctrine of Jesus going beyond death, is that the spirit of Jesus is in that realm. And that if after death I call on Jesus for help as I do while I'm alive, that I'll receive help from Jesus, the saints, the angels, and other spirit beings, which I think inhabit that realm.
So the Hindu and early more Gnostic teachings of reincarnation don't appeal to you?
Not really. I mean, the thing about having lived in India among Hindus who do believe in reincarnation, take it for granted, it's very different from reincarnation enthusiasts I meet here in Britain, who think it's a very good thing, reincarnation, and they want to really keen on the idea. In India, people take it for granted, but they're not keen on the idea. The whole point of the Hindu doctrines is that being reincarnated, you've just got to do everything all over again, you know, and the veil of tears repeated and samsara and stuff. Most of them don't want to be reincarnated. You know, it's a bad thing to be reincarnated, which is the point of a lot of Hindu spiritual practice, is to have a kind of vertical takeoff. So you can just escape from the bonds of karma and reincarnation and go into a kind of a vertical takeoff into a spiritual realm. If you fail, then you'll get reincarnated and you'll have to go through all the problems of childhood and again, adolescence, GCSEs, you know, not a terribly attractive prospect for a lot of people, including me. I don't take literally. I think some people, like children studied by Ian Stevenson, there are some cases where people do remember previous lives in a way that shows there really are memories that are transferred. Whether or not that means they're reincarnated is another question. I think we're all inheriting memories from lots of people in the past, a collective memory. It's part of bimorphic resonance theory. We may occasionally get particular memories from a particular person and get more from and memories from a particular person in the past. Doesn't necessarily prove we were that person. It may just prove that we have privileged access to their memories. But I myself don't think that I'll be, and I don't hope that I'll be reincarnated either.
No, I hear that. So here's a final question. And it relates to resonance and the morphic field and the state of the planet as a whole. Do you have a intuition, a feeling, a sense, an insight, of thoughts about the morphic field of humanity as a whole, and whether are you hopeful, not hopeful, realistic, philosophical, where This is you. What's the state of the world, Rupert?
Well, I mean, obviously, there's all sorts of terrible messes, wars coming to the fore again, conflicts of every kind, a breakdown of the economic system we've grown used to, environmental crisis, nuclear threat, etc., pandemics. You could break down a social of society, all the bonds that hold families and social groups together, fraying and dissolving into kind of individualism. All of these are obviously massive problems. I mean, there are hopeful things as well, of course. But I'm hopeful. It's different perhaps from being optimistic. Optimistic means you believe things will get better. I'm not sure I do believe they'll get better, but I hope they'll get better. And hope is empowering. If one hopes that things can be better, one does things that could help make them better. And the opposite of hope is despair. In French, it's literally the opposite, désespoir. Unhope is despair. And despair is disempowering. People are depressed, who can't get on with anything much, and people who despair don't do anything, whereas hope is empowering. And so I think it's important to be hopeful, even if things seem pretty grim. And after all, on a day-by-day basis, most of us are leading incredibly privileged lives. I mean, we've got enough food, enough heating, enough clothes. We've got amazing health services, modern dentistry. Countryside we can walk in without fear. We're unbelievably fortunate in all sorts of ways. So I think counting one's blessings and being hopeful are really important. And if enough people are hopeful and do something about it, then things could and probably will get better in some ways at least.
So is there a logic in saying then that if you are hopeful as opposed to despairing, there's a vibration through the morphic field that is a has a benevolence to it that is in itself useful?
Well, I wouldn't put it quite in those terms, but I
Okay.
think being hopeful means one has a more positive attitude to things one can do. One thinks of constructive things to do. One works with other people in a more constructive way. And I suppose that a hopeful attitude is contagious, perhaps by morphic resonance, just as despair can be contagious. If you're with somebody who's really in a dark depression with despair and who's negative about everything, it's a depressing experience to be with such a person because it rubs off. And if you're with somebody who's hopeful and energetic and trying to do, something good for themselves and for others, then that rubs off too. It usually makes you feel more active and hopeful yourself.
Okay, so we've come to the end of our time together. I'm hugely grateful. It's 8:34. I know you're cooking a meal for friends in the house.
Yes.
But before you go off, oh great chef, do you have any final thoughts, words of wisdom, anything you'd like to say? Or presumably everybody can find all the documents and books on your website.
Yes. I mean, my website, sheldrake.org, has all my books listed and descriptions of them, has links to my YouTube channel and to my podcast channel, which is called Navigating Consciousness. All my scientific papers are there in full text. I mean, there's a huge amount of material on my website, so anyone who's interested can find out more there.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. I don't go in for sort of final words of wisdom kind of thing, but I suppose the main thing is to wish everyone well and hope that others can be hopeful, because I think that's the attitude that will actually help us. It helps us to be hopeful. It's not one doesn't do it for selfish reasons, but it does actually have a benefit, and it just makes life fuller, more positive, and hopefully will help others and help the world.
Yeah. Rupert, thank you. Now, I'm going to do a Zoom thing here. I'm going to remove the spotlight from you and from me. And if we go into gallery, then everybody can do a kind of a wave of gratitude and just to you. Let me see if I can remove my spotlight as well. John or Izzy, can you remove my spotlight? Do you know how to do it? Sorry for this little glitch for the moment. Yes, no. There we go. Great. So listen, everybody, let's give Rupert a wave of gratitude for a wonderful conversation. Rupert, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Lots of love to you, and thank you for the blessings of the conversation and your words. Thank you so much, everybody. And thank you, everybody. Lots of love to you all. Be well. Blessings. Bye.